You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
I have to be motivated and love what I do to do it.
Yeah.
I think the only time in my career that I did something purely for money was to pay for my honeymoon. I accepted the Boy George tour.
Hello and welcome to another episode, a very exciting episode of 2020. My name's Corey Peza, here as always with Benny Goodman and our roving reporter, Siobhan Cronin, out on the road. Where are you right now?
Tuning in from somewhere in Nebraska.
There we go.
We just left Lincoln, where he had a show.
We knew this was going to happen someday. I'm glad we were able to make it work.
Yeah.
You ain't in Kansas anymore, baby.
We're super pumped to welcome back our British ambassador, along with Richard Shaw, Steve Wood.
My spirit animal. And you should just listen to him. There's nothing more that needs to be said. He's just going to throw you into it like the Matrix, and you're just going to have to deal with it because he's Steve Wood. And because of that, you should just hashtag Steve Wood and tell us what you think down below in the comments and subscribe. 2020-D.com. Watch it on YouTube. Cheers.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of 2020. I'm here as always. I'm Siobhan Cronin with my friends and cohorts, Corey Peza and Benny Goodman. How are you guys doing?
Great as always.
I'm here with Steve Wood, so I couldn't be in a better place right now. There's nowhere else I'd rather be.
Well, it's both ways. I couldn't be in a better place.
Ben jumped the gun a little bit, but I'm here to tuning in from the tour bus of Starset as we are on tour right now. But we have a wonderful guest coming back once again for, I guess, parts 3 and 4, this would be, with Steve Wood
of
Shelter Music Group. Thank you so much for coming back to hang out with us. Thank you for dealing with my crazy logistics
this month while I'm touring. Someone very familiar with touring himself, right?
Who was just talking to us about how many tours he's done in Japan while we were just getting ready to start the show. So without further ado, let's jump right in.
The senior manager at Shelter Music.
There he is.
The man.
You got it. The myth,
the legend, the grand poobah himself, Mr. Steven Wood.
In my own mind. Yes, that is absolutely right. I can't tell you how excited I am to be back. I've been thinking about this ever since I last did it. And I'm just so excited. And I hope I can deliver what you guys think this is going to be, because I'm excited.
Sounds like you have obsessive thoughts. Lamictal helps me with that.
I do. I'm the neurotic manager.
There you go.
Oh, we've got the neurotic guitarist and the neurotic manager. Well, we definitely love your enthusiasm. And, you know, the last two shows, if the listeners haven't checked it out, don't forget to like and subscribe to 2020-D.com. We had Steve Wood on before with amazing, amazing stories.
And he was so excited he had to come back to tell more.
I
would go as far as to say that some of the best stories that I've ever heard from any human being ever. And dare I say, his neurosis is contagious.
Yeah. Lucky I only gave you some of the medium ones. I kept the better ones in case you called me back.
All right.
Woo!
We called them. We called them. We texted him. We faxed him. We sent a pigeon his way. We actually had Johnny Depp call him and ask him if he would send us a letter. And then the letter got to us by, again, a passenger pigeon who handed it off to the Fox. And then my friend told me, who's the guy that owned the Fox, that the Fox wasn't feeling so good, and then SOS'd us. And then Steve got here.
That is true.
Here we are.
We have a sit down officially.
Wow. That just rolled right off your head, didn't it? All that amazing.
Rolled, spewed, spilled, something like that.
I'm glad to be here. I really am. And thanks again.
Absolutely.
So let's do it.
It's been a couple months since we talked to you. And can you just kind of fill us in with what's going on in your world right now?
Sure. Well, first of all, you know, we've been trying to reevaluate, rebook everything we had to cancel, postpone. It's like musical chairs. We're told we're doing this, and we go through all the process. We book the hotels, the bugs, the trusts, everything. And then it gets postponed, and then we have to start again. So we're just doing that with Godsmack, with Joe Perry, with the Hollywood Vampires. And I can tell you right now, we had a whole East Coast run with Joe Perry. He was actually playing the House of Blues in Boston. November. But it's just not safe enough for him. And many of the shows were in Florida. And I don't know if you guys are looking, but Florida is not doing well.
It sounds like you're playing musical chairs when really the game is duck, duck, goose.
Yes, yeah. And
you haven't ducked, and nor are you a goose.
No, but we are busy getting nowhere. That's what we're doing, basically.
Are you running to stand still?
Correct. That's a good way to put it. And it's not, you know, it's frustrating. It's disappointing. And what's more, if you're in my position, the large amount of income comes from global touring, not just U.S. And good luck doing a tour outside of the U.S. There is no such thing. Okay, the big festivals are being announced. The Rock and Ring, Rock and Pop, Download, Nova Rock, all those. But nobody's doing a 5 nights a week in Europe. It's not happening yet because Europe is not in lockstep with here.
Well, do you think that we're being crazy? Because I'll be honest with you. I was at Guns N' Roses the other day, and there were 60,000 people there. Yeah. And meanwhile, I'm talking to one of my friends who's in Indonesia, and he's like, I'm sorry, I can't go to the studio right now. We're on lockdown through August 2nd. And I didn't even know. I'm an American, right? I'm an American. I can go outside. I didn't even know that shit was blowing up around the world. I'm like, am I stupid for rocking out to Welcome to the Jungle? Am I going to die, Axel?
No, but one of the bands I manage, Like a Storm, three guys are from Auckland, New Zealand. They haven't even started doing COVID shots because they lock the island down and you can't get in or get out and they have no COVID. Same with Australia, where, you know, so you're not touring there. Japan, you're not going there. You're not going anywhere except here. And the latest news I have for Canada, I think on August 19th, we can cross the border now into Canada. I don't know, Siobhan, if the tour you're on has Canada on it.
No, we're just U.S. right now.
Yeah, well, they just announced it a few days ago that double vaccinated people can enter Canada. But we're still not back in black here. We're quite a way from that, actually. You know,
so what are venues in the process of trying to rebook some of these shows? What does it look like? Are a lot of venues still holding off? Are they saying we're definitely not going to have any shows? Are there certain areas of the country that are more open than others to, you know, continuing live music and booking acts?
Is that why there's all these places like Fenway Park? I see like a lot of these baseball gigs and all that sort of stuff. And it seems like a lot of these places that are like, I know Fenway's having like three times the amount of gigs now. Sure. Are people trying to do stuff outside? Is that why we're seeing stuff at Fenway and not the Garden?
Billy Joel, I think, was just at Fenway. Guns N' Roses were at Fenway. I think Green Day. Green Day are doing anywhere between 25 to 40,000 people a night. You know, like and a lot of it is we want to go out to a concert. We want to be entertained. We want concerts back. People are like desperate for entertainment. And the floodgates will open, not quite now. But if you look at it, the Rolling Stones are doing 13 dates. Now our company manages ZZ Top. And I actually thought the tour was going to be canceled, you know, when the bass player died, Dusty Hill.
But to the heavens. I mean, can we just take a moment and just take a moment of silence for Dusty? And we've been losing so many just amazing musicians that it's just been so sad. Like, we lost Joey Jordison from Slipknot the day before that, too. And it's just like, please stop and please let us see these people before they die.
Yeah. I like when Tom Petty died, I almost had tears because although I've seen him, it dawned on me, I'll never get a chance to do it again. And for me, I was all like, I hero worship that guy actually, because he was the real deal. He was. I don't know if I ever told you actually on the last show, but I was at his very first show in London.
And so what was that like?
Well, in England in those days, which would have been the late 70s, he was looked upon as American punk. I mean, believe it or not, because he had a skinny tie. I don't know if you remember the American Girl album.
And oh, I do.
And there was this big TV show called The Old Gray Whistle Test. And it was famous. It played progressive music on the BBC Two channel. And every band that was ever like progressive rock was on this. And he came over and did it. I was there because I was in the music business at this time. And I was at that show. And they had leather jackets and skinny ties. And they were called American punk. That's what it was. I mean, it wasn't, but that's what they labeled that guy. And I was there and I went to the after show party. Now, there's a word you won't be hearing anytime soon.
Right.
After show party.
You know, after show quarantine.
That's, like, that's almost as bad as
tour. You mean like the isopropyl alcohol wash party?
Yeah.
No, it was sex and drugs and rock and roll.
Well, I mean now. I mean now, like you can't go to an after show party. Yeah. They're just going to spray you down with like Listerine and say, get out of here.
Mainly because they don't have them. Because sure. There's a cost. And that's a no-no, you know. It's like tour support, guys. You know, when I was coming up in this business, record companies would actually support a band. And they go, well, if this doesn't work, you go back in the studio, you make another record, and we'll pay you to, you know, keep alive while you make a record and support your tour. Because that's how you sold records. Well, now we don't sell records. And so record companies, you got 3 months maybe, and then if the shit doesn't stick, well, see ya. And, you know, in my day, that was the holy grail, a record contract. When I managed my first band, I didn't care how bad it was. I made the worst deal in the history of mankind.
That was the name of our episode. So if people haven't seen it, go subscribe to 2020-D and listen to what actually is defined as the worst deal in history.
Yeah, yeah.
And why it happened, because it's hysterical, because Steve Wood, hashtag Steve Wood.
Got the deal. And I thought, that's it. We got it. We're there. It didn't matter to me. Now, I think most bands that have recording deals would wish they hadn't, and they weren't stuck with their labels. Because their labels basically say no to nearly everything that you want because there's a cost involved, and it's changed so much, you know. But we thought in those days that was it. You know, we'd hit the big time, a record deal. Now,
well, what I was going to say, not to interrupt you, but I think this is an interesting thing for listeners to hear, because I think there's a lot of smoke and mirrors about how the music industry actually works when it comes to what are you really aiming for when you put a band together and make a record. So can you maybe go into some more detail about some of the differences between, you know, earlier on a few decades ago versus now, like how the industry actually works and, you know, labels and management? Because I think it's a complex mechanism that a lot of people would be interested to hear more about.
Or even to dovetail on that, Siobhan, like what should people be looking for? Because you say like you wanted a record contract and now you're like people who have record contract, like the grass is greener on the other side of the fence. It's not making it having a record contract anymore. Can you make it? Like what even is the definition? What are we even trying for anymore?
Well, in the days when rock was in its infancy and coming up, the record contract was it. That was the be-all and end-all. That was it. And the only real way to promote the product that was live, magazines, newspapers, I mean, you know, printed, you know, print and touring and going to radio. Those were the big things. It really was. And once the music business changed the way it has now, when records no longer were being sold and streaming happened and social media happened, who's going to, you know, a magazine once a month? I mean, everything in it is old by the time it's out. It's
like owning an Encyclopedia Britannica. You can just get Google.
Yeah, because everything you want is here right now on this little box that I'm talking to you on, everything. And so now you really you need TikTok, you need social media presence, you need to be on YouTube. Bands don't even, like, a lot of them don't make records all together in the same room. They're like the way you do Lost Symphony.
Lost Symphony, yeah.
Someone I've never met Kelly.
Yeah, seriously. I mean, the band Like a Storm, my son's band, they made that record in all different parts of the world. They were never actually in the same room. And by the way, I should tell you, when they auditioned, my son Zach, for that this, I've never heard of this done before. So they were in some far-flung part of the world. They got two cameras. He set up his drum kit. They played the track. One camera was on his hands. The other camera was on his feet. And he played. And that's how he got the gig. They weren't there. I mean, I've never heard of such a thing.
That's like literally like an audit. Like that's like, we're not going to just tell you how we feel. We're actually going to count if you fucked up by how many milliseconds.
Yeah, that's,
like, that's bananas. But that also tells you, like, and you were saying this before, and I'll segue to this, that, you know, you saw some young child playing Marty Friedman so proficiently. But that's because we now live in an age where technology. So yeah, back in the day.
Well, you just had real quick, Ben, before we move on, we were actually going for a question there to get that I think he was getting around to with the
but we should come
with,
back to
with
that
the labeled support
good.
Thing. So I just want to make sure we wrap that up, because I know that the YouTube comments would be like, hey, what the fuck, Ben?
Now, I'm actually dealing with this with a new, trying to get a band signed. Now, you're more than likely to do a piecemeal deal. They're not going to want to lock you in for 10 tracks. And you have to ask yourself, is it wise to put 10 tracks on a record? Like when we were coming up in this business, we all listened to albums. People would come over to your house and you'd play music for one another, right? Now it's really like a one and done, and you put a track out and listen to that. I don't know if listening to 10 tracks is like, how valid is it? I mean, I don't know your opinions of it, but it seems to be less and less important. And one of the bands that I do manage puts a new track out every 2 months or so. And it actually is wise.
Well, I was actually just having this argument with our manager for Lost Symphony this morning, because he was like, okay, if we're going to do something else, because, you know, clearly we're making tons of money being in an instrumental shred band or whatever you want to call us, and he's like, if we're gonna do something else, we should, you know, stagger singles like every 2 months. I'm like, why don't we just do one song at a time? Corey came up with this amazing idea of just one song. Well, make every song the last song. He's like, Ben, it doesn't work that way. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure that's a smarter way. And if they want more every time, it's like, do you want another encore?
The reason I brought that up when we were discussing it was exactly what Steve's saying, is that's how people digest music. Like, why not focus on giving people our all on, you know, one thing that we can make special and unique, and then we'll ride that for a bit and we'll do the next thing.
Corey, try getting 45 minutes of somebody's attention.
Yeah. Right.
This, really, think about that. They're not going to donate that much of their time. And if they do, then it will turn into, after a while, into Muzak in the room. They're not listening.
Ben, I can already tell, doesn't have the attention span to listen to the end of your answer.
Well, the thing is that I wanted to say to that is that we did a really crazy experiment with somebody else's money, which makes it way easier with Lost Symphony, where we put out three records, and Corey here made about 150, maybe even more videos that are amazing. We put out so much intense, very hard to digest, like full-blown music that like could take, somebody could have milked this for 30 years. We put it out in like a year and a half. But now we were so pretentious in thinking that we could put this out. People are actually going back now because of that one song, Take Another Piece. They're going back finally and going, oh my God, there's all this stuff. And it's like, there's this world and we have this validation because it was all out there. But at one point, Corey's like 97 videos in, like, is this all for naught? As he's like whipping himself with a belt.
I agree with you guys. I really cannot. I mean, yes, albums will always be out. You know, the greatest hits or whatever, they'll always put them out. Bands do. But think about it. The ones that get the focus, they're the ones that are going to get heard in social media or on radio, terrestrial and like satellite. But I think the days of like an album is its validity is numbered, in my opinion.
I agree.
You're right.
One thing that kind of like it fits in with all that, and I've talked to a few artists that are doing the single game because, you know, financially it makes sense. If you're a younger artist, you don't have the support, just do one song at a time, push it, try to get the attention. So what they're doing is they're releasing one song every 2 months, and they're doing that for a year. And then they're taking those songs and making it an album. And now you have an automatic greatest hits because every song you put out is a single.
Exactly. So it's also given them the chance, to build an audience over time and get people interested. And I mean, it's interesting how people consume music differently.
Yes. And you make a video because it's very important. You do the, like your video is wonderful. It really is. Who directs those, by the way?
The singles philosophy.
The live ones. Yeah. The way you're all in different rooms, but.
Oh, yeah. So the ones you've seen for the singles are, that's me. I put those together.
They're really well done.
Oh, thank you. Well, there's not much direction. It's everyone sends in their footage, and then I try to make it look as
Actually, our last video, I filmed myself in a hotel room against a blue curtain.
So Corey, by the way, is a logistical and operational mastermind. So like what you're really referring to more than direction is the technicality of how unbelievable he was able to take Boris Groh's artwork and then incorporate all of our crappy camera footage and make it look like it was actually a work of art because of the music. But the thing that's really interesting about that is it's all happening because of Nuno Bettencourt. Because we normally do what everybody else
did.
Like for Take Another Piece. So he sends us the footage, you know, like last minute because he's a rock star. He gets whatever time he wants because he's Nuno. And he's like, but by the way, you're not going to do one of these Hollywood Square videos, which is like exactly what we were going to do. So we're like, fuck, we can't make Nuno angry. Because he's not nice when he's angry.
What do you want you to do?
So we forced Corey to, you have to think of something else.
Yeah, and it was literally do anything else other than those like quarantine jam
looking
videos.
Nuno was the producer of this.
Yeah,
this concept.
Basically, what we've learned is that when you make Corey totally frantic, that he comes up with his most creative work.
Oh, yeah, this was, by the way, less than 7 days before it was being released that I had to rework.
It's brilliant. I've watched it so many times, guys. I really have. I just think the way you dissolve from one to the other, it's...
Yeah, I'm glad it worked out.
You're very proud of it. You should be, because it's... how's it doing, by the way? I mean, are you happy with its appeal? And
Yeah. The response has been amazing. I think Take Another Piece was the one that really kind of opened the door.
Yeah.
And then our subsequent My Last Goodbye was able to kind of continue riding that wave and is getting a lot of attention. And we just dropped very recently the third one for Acceptance, which is, I think, just starting to pick up now. We just had it on Guitar
World. We just watched it on the weekend.
So we'll be curious to see how that one does. But
Siobhan, solo piece.
Yeah.
I'm interested to know what the end game is for you guys, because the talent...
Me too.
That's a great question.
What is our end game, Steve? Come on, you're a manager. Tell us. Write this down, Corey, whatever he says.
The end game must be to find acceptance, to get the word out and not be the best.
Accepting that we're going to be broke and then I have to go back to my fiance and tell her she's
like
not getting the bathroom
there.
She wants.
No, seriously. You've got something. You really do. It's something very special. And it's a crime if this is not exploited in a good way. I mean, what is your plan with it? You need to do something. I'm telling you.
Well, I'll tell you, Jason Lechberg, who Paul, your partner, was kind enough to send our way, came up with this ingenious, like, absolutely crazy, fanatical plan of rolling out three records and saying, this is the most effective way. And pretty much, like, you're going to make no money for this record. You're going to make no money for this record. And maybe if you're still good by this record, people will start giving a fuck. And actually, he was like Nostradamus.
Yeah, it's pretty dumb.
we pretty much our first record, like, we thought it was awesome. But they can't say it right off the bat. You guys are great. So people were like, okay, it's all right. Like 7, 6.5, whatever. But no one really cared. Second record came out. People were like, wow, that's pretty good. I can't believe no one's listening to you. And like, but they're like, this is genius as far as music. We got a few good reviews, a few like, who is this? And then we released Take Another Piece and everyone's like, these geniuses out of Genius Town came up with the greatest new music since the dawn of time. And it's like, bro, we have 177 videos out there. Like, we literally have been pumping out music. Like, we put out more music than Prince has since he's died.
But we still haven't answered the question, though, which is very important, is what is the end game? And I think that's such an interesting point to make, because you do, especially with the con. No, I mean, I can't even answer that question myself, you know, but it's interesting, you know.
Can I tell you what I want to do next, Steve, and that maybe you can help us figure out the end game? Because I can tell you what I'm scheming.
I was wondering about now, not about next, but anyway.
Well... Well, then, well, now, so I guess, so in my mind, what I see is, what, first off, the person behind this that's helped fund this, which is a lot of money. And so where people go, oh, like, you guys did great and so lucky. Like, we didn't even pay that much money to the people. It just costs so much money to make a thing like this run and to be able to have three albums out. And now finally people are like, well, and like, we got a call where Jason actually used the following term, our marketing guy. You guys have been likened to a rite of passage for musicians. And I'm like, what? He's like, yeah, people are saying that if they're on your record, that it's like a testament, like almost like that Frank Zappa thing.
Testament.
If you're in if you're in Frank Zappa's band, that you must be good. And we're almost getting that same sort of thing. And it's like, after three records, Corey literally never coming up for air, editing videos, all of us sending cell phone videos, calling each other, crying in the middle of the night, saying like, what the hell's going on? Sending tracks, going, I have to do it again. My brother erased the whole song. Like, all the shit's happening. We're like, how are we going to get the artwork? There's no metadata. What's metadata? Like, who did the publishing? There's publishing. Why didn't we talk to that guy? Who has the right to this? Why can't we
distribute
it?
Point being, we learned a lot through this process.
Yeah, so basically,
is what he's trying to say.
The end game is now to like reel this all in and finally to be able to put out music that people give a fuck about, and maybe they'll hang on our songs now.
Well, you're going to need, like, for example, I mean, Eddie Trunk, there's a guy. Do you know who he is? I mean,
oh, yeah, of course. I'm a metalhead. How can you not acknowledge Eddie Trunk? He's the one, he's one of the few dudes constantly in the trenches. In the trenches, like Ryan Roxy, another dude.
Why are you playing your music?
I don't know. Eddie Trunk, I don't know if he likes us. We had Satchel. He hates Steel Panther.
Well, that's a, you know, Steel Panther. Actually, you know, I don't know, just quickly changing courses, but Steel Panther, the bass player, left. So
what happened with that?
I thought maybe it was a joke when I saw the like headline for it. I was like, is this like
I know you left for sex addiction before, which I know wasn't exactly the truth. So I'm assumed this wasn't the truth. So what happened? Because he's with them for 4 years.
I can't get into that, but I can say he's not coming back. And and look, I mean, just sad. I know we've diverted from what we were talking about, but you mentioned Eddie Trunk doesn't like them. Lexi was like a really important part of that group to have that guy. Have you all seen them? You know exactly.
I haven't seen them live.
Siobhan, you've seen them, or were you?
I haven't seen them live, but we talked to Satchel, and I've seen videos and listened to the albums.
Yeah. Well, he left, and I asked if he's coming back, and they said no. They had a guy who was their tour manager, dresses up like Nikki Sixx with the big tank glasses on, but that doesn't really work. He was perfect, Lexi.
Yeah,
it was that guy who was so dumb he didn't even realize it. I mean, he did. Yeah. He was this like. Anyway, he's gone, and I'm going to be interested to see how they succeed. I have my doubts, actually. It's a shame. We managed them for 10 years, actually.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, that's interesting because Satchel did bring up, I remember in that episode, for anyone that hasn't listened, go back and check it out. But that was one of the things he called on as the strengths of Steel Panther was the fact that they, through thick and thin, stayed together and they never changed
years.
Lineup.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now he's not. So they're going to miss that because he had Lexi would stand there and didn't say much, but he'd be having the mirror with Lexi and Diamante on the back with his hair dryer. And he would say the most, I can't think of the right word. They were the so inappropriate words. They were totally, and they'd all stop and look, what?
Yeah, and the chemistry was phenomenal.
It was brilliant. Yeah. They played off each, and they weren't rehearsed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so you can't just change that. I mean, it just happened. Like the synchronicity of it was amazing. So I don't know what's going to happen to. But getting back to Eddie Trunk, I think you need an outlet to bring attention to what you're doing, because anybody that can appreciate the quality of what you do can only love what you're doing. I mean, there's no two ways about it. If you can get them to watch it and hear it, you win.
So wait, do I just tell Eddie, like, do I just like write him like, hey, I'm a dude with a black shirt and I'm in a band and we're the best band since Pantera and you should probably check it out and here's my link.
I could speak to Eddie Trunk for you?
Well, that's very different than like me inboxing Eddie Trunk and being like, yo, dude, so I'm in a band, because I'm sure that that poor Eddie Trunk gets plenty of that.
Then you hear the phone going, meh. No, I mean, Eddie, I actually wished him happy birthday today, funnily enough. But I mean, there's an idea. Because right, I think what's happening with your music, you put it out and then just hope for the best, right? I don't know. But
well, we don't know. We're good at making music. We're not good at getting the product off the shelf. If we were, we'd probably be rich, right?
Yeah, we rely.
Nor should you be. You should keep knowing what you know and stay in that lane. And you're in that lane. You're brilliant at it. You know, that you need other people who are brilliant at that to bring attention to this.
Yeah, and we have a very great marketing team, PR people, and like our social media. You know, we strive to create interesting content, not just music. We do the playthroughs, we do interviews, we make sure we talk, because there's no lyrics, we like to talk about the songs and what they mean. We go through the artwork. You know, there's definitely layers that people can dive in and find. So it's not like people just hear the song and there's nowhere to go. But you know, we are always looking for ways to, you know, being instrumental and being such this kind of niche band, to connect with people a bit more. And you know, the ideal situation would be able to bring this show live, which is just seems like an insurmountable feat because of the way we built it. But it's, you know, we're always just trying to think of different ways to connect
with people.
I
mean, look, if Eddie Trunk wanted to help us out and be like, hey man, we'll help you get it out live, maybe I'll call Zach Wilde and tell him to play some shows with you, and we get some lasers we can borrow from Steel Panther, because those are cool dudes. And look, maybe Maiden will let us borrow like the Somewhere in Time set that they didn't let Incubus borrow, but like I know there's a bunch of Eddies running around somewhere.
We'll get a bunch of secondhand stuff.
And we'll call Ryan Roxy and we'll see if we got some Alice Cooper's heads lying around. And look, we'll put a fucking show together, Steve, and we'll get you on the road. And if you can handle Dave Mustaine, you can handle me.
Yeah, and Sully.
Oh, Jesus, man. Could you imagine Dave Mustaine, Sully, and Nuno all in the same band?
Yeah, I actually got well known for handling extremely complex artists, let's put it like that. You know, like Trent Reznor.
He's complex.
Dark.
Well, he did have the door from the house that Charlie Manson's people killed.
He recorded his album.
But he did give it back, though, I heard. I heard he felt bad about it after, for like making a bunch of Manson records.
What was it like, you know, managing him and working with him?
I can tell you. You walk in the room and he doesn't say anything. And you think, I'll come back. You feel so awkward.
Yeah.
And so when we were traveling, I remember on many occasions we'd be in a van after a gig going to, like, we headlined Coachella, and he'd be sitting right behind me and he'd be texting me questions. I'm going,
it does work for Apple, so that makes sense.
But it was, let's put it, he wasn't really a people guy, you know? I mean,
the guy that wrote Head Like a Hole, Black is a Soul, I'd Rather Die Than Give You Control, Steve Wood.
Yeah, that's right. But intense show. I mean, intense.
Best light show I've ever seen. In fact, there's a documentary online that I recommend everyone go see, that's the design of his whole tour set. And I remember seeing them at Lollapalooza. And I got to tell you, I've seen a lot of shtick between the Kiss thing, the Slipknot thing, the fire from the Guns N' Roses. And no one has ever wowed me with just, I guess, the technicality and the beautiful live to LED to like not knowing the suspension of disbelief that Trent Reznor was able to create with some dude he found on the internet on some fan site years ago that just went, I'll put you to work.
It's very black and white too. It's very stark. It's very jarring what he does. And it's crazy intense, crazy. And he's covered in sweat. And, but you know, it wasn't the most fun I've ever had. I mean, it just wasn't, you know, I'll be honest. It wasn't. But, you know, get back to you guys. Could you play live? I mean, is it possible?
I mean, Kelly didn't exist, supposedly. So, I mean, he... Yes.
Well, the thing is, the lineup consists of people that are all over the place. So I guess to keep the same lineup.
I have thought about this extensively, like, So, Steve, if we were actually going to logistically do this, the way I would think about it is we'd have to have the core band of our an unbelievable drummer, which hopefully would be Paul, who's on the album, but, like, you know, maybe a Shannon Larkin or someone of that ilk. And then Corey on bass, obviously. Myself, I'd probably be the Mike Patton floating from guitar and piano or whatever I had to do at that moment. We're going to have backing tracks, as you know, the whole thing sunk up to DMX 512 protocol we're borrowing from Starset. We'll have live strings with Siobhan, and then we'll have Kelly, our guitarist. We'll probably have to hire another guy, hopefully a Jeff Loomis or a Joey Concepcion that's good enough. And then we do it live to a we have to have the show.
Siobhan can be there too. Yeah.
It's going to be a showcase. It's not just playing live at the Paradise Theater Boston.
No, it has to be big or go home. It has to be Trans-Siberian Orchestra level or not at all. And that's the way we realized that. We can't play a club. We'd have to do something where we faked it until we made it, and we'd have
well,
to
I think
like, do
what
a
we
one-off
need to
gig
do,
or something.
I mean, it really is naturally a multimedia thing because there's so much artwork involved in it too, and a bit of a storyline. So I think, yeah, somehow incorporating the storyline and some sort of production for it to be more
amazing
immersive, because that's really
not
what it is.
You're right. It has to be really like spectacular production, and with a storyline, and you know your core players. It could be an event. I really think so. I mean,
listen, if you want to sell this to sponsors, it sounds like a logistical nightmare to me.
But I'm curious to hear what you're saying, Steve.
Go on.
Well, I'll tell you. I mean, like, when I was managing Alterbridge, you know, Mark Tremonti every night would do a clinic for the shred community. And they'd pay, what, like $100 or whatever it was. And he would spend an hour or two being a tutor. And there's shred people were in every city. They were everywhere. And it wasn't, there's a whole thing about the shredding community, you know? I mean, I'm sure you know, you're playing with these guys. And so there is an audience for this. I mean, these people would fork over their hard-earned cash. And I would love to see you go forward because it's kind of static, you know? You're out on YouTube and you're hoping for the best, but you've got something special. You really do.
Well, I guess it's always been one of those things where we hope that we're the pretty girl that somebody just notices us from far away and just happens to say, oh yeah, I should give you to Eddie Trunk, because you're right, that there is no linear path for our success. We don't see it. And if we knew what it was, we'd be doing it. So we have put ourselves out there in the hopes that people will find legitimacy in what we do and that they think it's good enough. And I'll tell you, it's been very, very nice because the response, at least to this record, has been so good that it feels like my mom's writing these PR reviews. So it is validating. So like, at least we're getting like the respect now, but like, that doesn't mean I can pay my electric bill.
Well, and I will say, to add on to that, that even on this Starset tour, like, I've toured for many, you know, years, and no one's ever mentioned Lost Symphony. In every city, somebody has asked me about Lost Symphony, which is really amazing because, you know, it just proves that there has been some momentum that's picked up and people are finally kind of understanding the concept. I think that's where you got to start from, for sure.
I think we should just send Siobhan out on tour and then we can sit back and
I think more people, just from people I've talked to, I bring it up to everybody that I talk to, and some people are like, oh, that sounds amazing. I would totally listen to that. So
you got to think that Marty Friedman, Alex Skolnick, these people would talk about this, and they do have an audience. They do. There are outlets that
Mari doesn't want to talk about this, though, because Mari, I feel like, as much as I love him, but Mari controls everything. So like, he doesn't have control over this. So he's like, he appreciates us. He totally supports us. He's the greatest guy.
Yeah.
He literally is the most classy person I've ever met. But does he want to talk about us? No, because he doesn't control Benny, Corey, or Siobhan.
Well, he curates his message and his image and his branding
intensely. Yeah.
He's highly curated.
This is not on brand with Mari.
Well, it depends who asks him, isn't it?
Well, I mean, listen, again, it's me inboxing Marty. Hey, I'm Steve Wood's friend, Benny. Remember me, the guy that's emailed you? He's like, how did you get this email?
No, well, look, I mean, if it was me, for example, I actually wrote to him today. You know, we have a sort of long-distance love affair. We've been friends for a long time. I can't imagine him not being involved in, like, talking about you.
Well, so you know, actually, this is a very good segue, because one of the things we're trying to do, and we haven't even spoken to Corey about this, but I had a call with the guy behind everything. So the Neurotic guitarist, as you know, which I am, we have all three Jason Becker guitars, all three of them that were on the chopping block at Gurney's. And that money obviously goes directly to Jason, and it was with the blessing of Marty Friedman, because Marty, who's worked with us, vouched for us to Jason, which I can't even tell you how much that means to me. But what we've promised in return is to continue raising awareness, because the thing is, you know, someone like Herman Lee, God bless that man for bringing so much attention to Jason Becker and helping. But Herman Lee is a guy that is known by people that love Jason Becker because he's a shredder. He's from another planet of shred. But what we want to do is people who don't know Jason, we want them to learn his story. We want them to understand and feel what's going on. We want to use these guitars and put them in hands of people that you wouldn't necessarily see, so that we can speak the message and help raise awareness for the charities that he's involved in, and for the what people go through with ALS, with MS, with any type of debilitating disease like that. And the fact is, Jason's a hero. And my hope is, and I'm going to say it here in front of everybody, that we've been talking to Jason, and Jason's all about us using his guitars on the next Lost Symphony song. His guitars only. So recording with it.
Story right there.
But I would like Jason to co-produce the song with us.
There's another story right there. You see, there's a lot of ammunition. And I don't, maybe you're not thinking about it, but there is. There's a lot you got going for you. It just hasn't been coordinated. It hasn't been put together.
Steve, we can't afford you, okay? You keep selling us on you, but we can't afford you. You're at Shelter Music. We need give me Shelter.
No, I would do this for free because you deserve it.
Are you taping this, Corey? Is this live?
It's a binding agreement.
I don't.
That's what Judy said.
I have to be motivated and love what I do to do it.
Yeah.
I think the only time in my career that I did something purely for money was to pay for my honeymoon. I accepted the Boy George tour.
Did that hurt? Did that hurt you?
It still hurts you. Well, I'll tell you a couple of things about it.
Was this when he was tying up slaves? Like, was this when he was like tying up his escorts?
Well, let him tell the stories that he has. Don't derail.
He was going through, and this is common knowledge, addiction issues. And I got the call by his manager. And I knew I was getting married soon, and I wanted to go to a private island in the Caribbean, you know, this beautiful island called Petit Saint Vincent. And so I met with his manager, and his manager was a very sort of the upper class British Rolls Royce chauffeur. Look, I sail, chap. It was all that, right?
And so I play that game at the airport all the time. You can't work it on me like that.
I play it all the time too. And it works. But so he calls me. I go to his office. And he sees me in his secretary says, well, go in. Tony will see you now. And I sit down, this guy, Rolls Royce outside, chauffeur waiting just in case. And he says, now look here, old boy. He says, George is a rather sensitive fellow. But good thing to do is after a show, he says, just tell him, just say, oh, you were fabulous. Just tell him that. And that'll go down well. I said, okay, Tony, what happens if he wasn't? Oh, well, just lie, old boy. That's what he told me, just lie. And so I did this tour, and it was a nightmare. I'm going to tell you this little snippet. During the tour, we were seeing doctors every day to give him, you know, the medications he needed. Some were placebos, some were real. I carried the bag. At one tour in the Hallenstadion in Zurich, it's an arena. He was so gone, he didn't know where he's going. And he walked into the back of the backdrop, like, swear to God. And then he started crying and walked off stage during the show. Just walked off, got his assistant, they got in the car and drove away. And he went to England. Now I'm left with the band and crew and buses and trucks. Oh, I'm going, God, what are we gonna do? And the manager said, well, old boy, he says, where's the next city? And I said, Paris. Well, go over there, get there, and give me a call. And I'll let you know what we're doing. So everybody, we go off to Paris. I arrive. Tony, Steve, we're in Paris. What's happening? It's not today, old boy. where's the next one? Milan. Okay, go to Milan and give me a call. And this went on for a week. A whole thing just going around the country, me calling, and we didn't have cell phones then. And that's how it went. And it was incredible. It's nuts, but we did it. And the last show, we were in Iceland, in Reykjavik, okay? Now, have you ever, I probably haven't been to Iceland, have you? Many people.
No, I haven't.
Oh, no, I vacationed at the Blue Lagoon on the regular.
It's like the moon.
It's an ultra spa there. It's really nice, the infinity pool.
No, seriously, it's like the moon. It looks like the moon. And people drink like there's no tomorrow. Because what the fuck are you going to do? I mean, you're in Iceland. Nothing. Right, so they drink.
Century eggs, Steve. That's what you do. You eat a century egg.
Well, what's a century egg?
You don't know this? I learned this from Anthony Bourdain. They take an egg and then they bury it and they let it putrefy. And then you dig it up and it's a delicacy and they call it a century egg. It's not 100 years old, but it's like at least 100 days old.
The Koreans do that with their kimchi. They bury.
I thought you said their kids. So I was like, that's dark.
Kimchi. Anyway, so listen, we're in Reykjavik, right, with George. Last show of the tour. And the wardrobe assistant couldn't do it. So he hired this guy. And this is not a gay slur, but this guy was extremely homosexual. Let's put it that way. Hand on the hip, smoking, was very... gesticulating all the time, right?
Sure.
And his name was Judy, I believe. And so he was going to do baggage for the wardrobe. He was doing all of that.
Doesn't he already have his own?
Well, he couldn't do the tour, this guy that he uses. So he used this guy, Judy. And so we're doing the show. And the deal is, after the tour ends, all of his wardrobe gets put into the limousine. He walks off stage. And George, myself, and Judy, this guy, and security, zoom off to the hotel. And I research it with this guy, Judy, 100 times. This is what we do. He goes, right, got it. Now, this guy was hopeless alcoholic. I mean, he was just drinking the whole time, right? So end of the show, George off stage. Everything ready, Judy? Oh, yeah, it's fine. Get in the car. We're gone. Driving. I said... just to be sure, Judy, the bags are in the back, right? Darling, I don't do bags. He wasn't going to carry them. I had to go all the way back and get the suitcases. It was just the way he said it while smoking. Darling, I don't do bags. True story. Crazy. You know, when I think back on some of the things that I've seen doing what I do, some of the stories, I mean, that, oh my God, it's nuts.
But so anyway. let me ask you this. You've worked with some nefarious creatures in this world. It's one of the things that you and I, so Steve and I, first off, I have to say that I very much appreciate our friendship, because Steve sends me guitars and I send him guitars, and then we revel in our emotional problems and our outlets. And I find that, like, you're my kindred spirit across, like, wherever you are. I'm just like, I think about you. I'm like, is Steve thinking about me too? You know, but I want to know. I want to know, do you, with all these people, what do you want to tell me? Because when we were talking last, I said this would be a great outlet for you autobiographically, because you have so many stories. I'd have to think that it must be like almost anxiety ridden to think about trying to write it down. Tell us something you've wanted to tell people. Like, give us a tour story that, like, we wouldn't believe, because Boy George is not the person I would have asked about.
It'll be about Kiss.
All right, I'm in. Let's go. What era?
We are in Lubbock. Lubbock, Texas, rehearsing the Hot in the Shade tour with the Sphinx. this huge Sphinx, and we're in the arena. And for some reason, Gene Simmons knows how, if the lighting's good while he's on stage. I don't know any other musician that can tell, but he can, right? And so we're rehearsing, we're there for like 5 days rehearsing the tour, and we're in the arena and we're going through rehearsals, and the lighting designer is a very good friend of mine. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us, but his name was Dino.
And cheers to people, Dino, wherever you are, Dino.
Yeah, thank you. People don't have names with Kiss. They have titles, you know, like, and Gene said, Steve, I had a name, actually. Get lights in here. And he's like, uh-oh.
Do you mean like, Steve, get lights in here.
That's right. And so I go into the dressing room where he's telling me this, and they're being, him and Paul are being fitted for cowboy boots. With this guy, he's got all the stuff he needs, and he's measuring out their feet, and he's making cowboy boots because they're in Texas. I said, Dino, Gene wants to talk to you. Dino was one of these guys that didn't have much in the way of facial expressions. He just, like, it was nothing all the time. Walk in, Gene, Dino's here. He turns around and he looks at Dino and sees there's no expression there. And he walks up to him and goes, hello. I go, oh my God, here it comes. Here we go. Dino, nothing. He goes, watch and learn. Picks up his guitar, picks it up, walks over to the door and does this, like with the feet up. And he goes, boom, like that. And as he does it, turns the light off in full darkness. Again, guitar up, boom, darkness. And he just turned round and went back to his boots. And Dino didn't say a word. He just looked like, what the fuck just happened? And it's, I swear to God, a true story. I mean, and that was it. And Gene was a man of very few words, but he got his point across really well.
He wanted the blackout at the end of the thing. Is that what he's saying?
Yeah. I mean, could Dino was just standing there.
Well, let me ask you this. Are we respecting Dino for the no facial expression, or am I supposed to be respecting Gene Simmons for his absolutely, completely insurmountable, crazy, narcissistic way of dealing with things? So, because I was going to say, because I got to tell you, that's a good way to rule if you have an oligarchy.
Yeah. Well, this other time, we're at the Forum in Los Angeles. This is another great one. Steve, get security in here. Okay? Sold out Forum show. I'd hired this guy who went on to be the tour manager for Tina Turner eventually, right? Australian guy. Patrick comes in the room, says, and he's just started with the band, so he's kind of nervous and he wants to do a good job. Gene, Patrick's here. Patrick, how do the passes work here tonight? Don't forget, Kiss, the Forum, sold out. Patrick begins to give him the history of the backstage passes, the photo passes, the working passes. And Gene is looking like him, like he's a complete blithering idiot. You can see it starting with Gene. And then and he can't take it anymore. Stop. And then Patrick's like, oh, what have I done? And I'm thinking, here it comes. Patrick, he says. He was telling him the backstage does this, the one with the triangle does that, the rectangle one means you can do it. Well, Patrick, allow me to educate you. There are two types of people that come to a Kiss concert. There's the scum and the cool people. And I'm not interested where the scum are going tonight. He wanted to know where his people go, I guess, for passes.
No, I get it. I mean, listen, I read, he has a book about power. And the first chapter is something to the extent of, hi, I'm Gene Simmons. I invented myself. I'm from Israel. The reason I'm successful is because I told everyone I'm going to be successful. I actually made me. The reason I'm me is because I wrote it down and said that I'm going to be tall. I'm going to use my tongue. I'm going to have blood. And I'm going to do all these things. You too can do that as well if you're narcissistic, egocentric, and have enough money that you can actually tell people what to do because you're really tall and people listen to you because you have a deep voice. And you're the God of Thunder.
In the Four Seasons Hotel, Gene and I were sitting in the lobby. He calls over the waiter, calls the guy over. He goes, I think I'd like some chocolate chip cookies. I goes, well, I'm terribly sorry, sir. We don't actually have any. He says, what do you mean you don't have any? This is the Four Seasons. He goes, well, I'm very sorry. He says, where's the kitchen? Oh, God. Right, take me to the kitchen now. And this guy's like, okay. And we go into the kitchen and he instructs the chef how to make his chocolate chip cookies. Right there in the Four Seasons in Houston.
Did you have any of those cookies?
Yeah, they made them.
Were they good?
Because it's Gene Simmons.
Hold on, but so was it worth it?
For the experience, it was priceless.
I did. Well, that's just what I want to know. Like, were the cookies worth it, though? Like, were they? Because I'm with Gene in this. Because I one time went to the Bristol Lounge at the Four Seasons in Boston, right? And I ordered an egg for $40. And it was supposed to be a poached egg. And I'm going to tell people right now that if my egg doesn't run, it could make or break my day. And literally, pun intended. So they came over and they take all the crumbs off your table, the whole nine, and they watch you as you cut your egg. And I had my salmon. It's not lox there. It's salmon. It's like Nova Scotia salmon because it's too expensive to be lox. And it's got capers as they're supposed to have. And I go to cut it. And instead of it bleeding the beautiful yolk, it's just this congealed sadness. And I look up at the waiter. Sad, and they take it away from me. But I thought to myself, just like Gene Simmons, how could the Four Seasons possibly fuck this up?
Well, yeah, he wouldn't have stood for it.
They're cookies, man. Everyone wants cookies. Gene.
Well, it sounds
right.
Like for Gene Simmons, no is not an acceptable answer.
It's just a segue to yes.
Yeah. By the way,
25,000 women.
That's true. Because he's a man of few words, he carries these little yellow post-it notes. And he can basically say what he wants on one of those. That's what he does. He just gives that to
you. So would you say
if he's any type of
word, he's not a noun, he's not an adverb, he's an interjection.
An interjection?
One. He's a wow. But he's a fuck. He's got an exclamation point. You know what I mean? Like,
it was amazing, Benny. I mean, the things we did, the things we saw, the stories I got, the experiences, to travel the world and to be able to get a living out of doing that and to have these stories and these things you can talk about. It's really special.
It's incredible, and we enjoy hearing all of them, and we are going to hear more in part two, I assume, because we're gonna wrap this one up. But I'm leaving a couple minutes because I assume Ben's going to talk for a couple here. But Steve, as always, we appreciate your time. We appreciate your knowledge.
Oh, I love
it. And the advice and any guidance you have for us.
Yeah, great guidance in this
You know,
one.
We are sponges when you're in our presence here, so we appreciate
it. I want you to succeed, and I want to help do it, because it's criminal if it doesn't, because the talent is undeniable here.
Well, and I have to tell you that it's been such a humbling experience to be able to first off speak to you and to Paul, because if you watch his episodes, like, he had us like, I mean, I almost cried. Like, he's like, at the end of the first episode he did with, like, and then Queen basically called us to come in and play the show. And we're like, oh my God.
Yeah.
And like, I mean, he's very blasé about it. Like, you know, he's like, oh yeah, bud, we just sold out Wembley Arena and then, like, you know, came back and our song was the biggest thing and, you know, whatever. with you, you've been so candid with us and you've been so nice and you've been so indulgent. I have to say thank you. And I truly, look, We made this music just like every band. You know, we have that belief in ourselves. We're like, we hope that people say what you're saying, and we hope that people want to send us to Eddie Trunk. We hope people want to see us live. We hope people want to this to go on. But the reality of it is it's almost impossible, and we feel like we've been trapped under ice. So we appreciate your help. And just so everyone else knows, like, even though we play with Marty Friedman and we have Jeff Loomis and all this you think that we're living large, I'm still on Mass Ave and Tremont Street in Boston, like from 7 to 9, asking for change.
But there's opportunities that you are not doing that you could be. And that I'm sure of.
That is a story of our lives. Yeah. On that note,
you've been 2020.
Next episode.
Yeah.
Steve, you stick around and talk to us later this week, please.
Yeah. I'm proud to be 2020.
Thank you, as always, for checking out this episode of 2020. Please visit 2020-D.com, like and subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss out on future episodes. This week's throwback clip is from episode number 89, featuring Mikey Doling and Shannon Larkin. Check it out.
How about this? We had the snot house, right? All the guys in snot lived together in one house.
Yes.
Okay. And we rehearsed next to the local strip club next door. So we'd be jamming in the day, take a break, and go into the strip club, pull the strippers out. Oh yeah, they'd be wanting to hang out with us because we're snot. And they'd come and watch us jam, and then we'd take them back to our apartment. Or not apartment house, the snot house, and they would buy us all groceries, and you know, they had money, we didn't.
Hey, what's up? My name's Lurk, and I'm the host of Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast. Every week, I have in-depth conversations with bands from all over the scene, big and small. We also like to keep our finger on the pulse and showcase up-and-coming bands on the show as well. So come check out Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast.